Our responsibility as Jewish people, particularly as Hasidim, is to influence and elevate the world. But we cannot do that if we ourselves are invested in the world. This sicha is on the topic of both the parasha of Vayishlach and Yetzias Kislev. Kvekdushim Rebichame Admur Siper, Shebeshabbos Parashas Vayishlach, Tov Kuf Lamed Gimel, Ashabbos Achrein Elchayor, Rav Magid Mezrich, Bechayim Chayusu Balmadein, the Friedrich Rebbe tells that on the last Shabbos of the Magid of Mezrich, whose Yotzad is Yetzias Kislev, the Magid Omar Beshichva Al Mitosoi, the Magid said while he lay on his bed, Mamaimed Achevraya Kadisha, surrounded by his holy students, he said, Vayishlach Yaakov Malochim. The Torah tells us that Yaakov sent Malochim angels to Esav. Appears Rashi, Malochim Mamash. Rashi explains, Malochim literally sent angels, not messengers as you might think it is. Says the Magid of Mezrich, Hamamash Shalom Malochim Sholach Yaakov Le'esav. Aval Ruchnis Nisharim Yaakov. That the emphasis of the word Mamash also means that which is tangible, is that Yaakov sent the tangible element of the angels to Esav, but the spiritual soul of those angels he retained. It's a well-known story amongst Chassidim, and the Rebbe asks some questions about it. Number one, Zeh sheshalach Yaakov reis malochim dafka, af shebichal losel ishamash im melochim, the fact that Yaakov sent angels to Esav is surprising, because you're not supposed to use angels for your own personal use. V'loi b'nei Adam, and he didn't send people, so the logical reason must be because he didn't only simply want to send a message to Esav, but he wanted to refine and elevate Esav. Key part of our conversation, to refine and elevate Esav. That's why he specifically chose to send angels, so they could impact Esav and they could elevate Esav. Which only raises the question if Yaakov Avinu's intention is to send Malochim because he wants to elevate Esav, then logically he should have sent the spiritual dimension of the angels, because that's where the power would come from to elevate Esav. So it doesn't seem to make sense. If the goal is to elevate Esav, why only send the tangible part of the Malochim? And secondly, Gam be'etzem ayinayinu muvan. That's a technical detail. Now let's talk about the whole story, because the whole story doesn't seem to make sense. How do you split malachim? How do you split an angel? How do you detach the soul from the body, whatever the tangible part of the angel is, and you send the tangible part to Esav and you retain the neshama by Yaakov? Seems illogical. It's completely illogical. In the physical world, a human body or an animal's body cannot do anything without its neshama. The neshama keeps it alive. Now, if that's true for the physical realm, how much more so for an angel, which is primarily soul? So what is this disembodied or this unsouled part of the tangible angel that's getting sent to Esav? What is this thing? How does it even work? Gam sarach lavin. And there's a third thing we need to understand. Mipashas pirusha sharashim melochim mamash nirah shekavanos lishlol apirusha sholach shluchim bosev edom. At face value, if you read Rashi's comment that Malachim literally means angels, so it would appear that what he wants us to know is that it doesn't mean people, because the word Malachim could mean messengers, so he wants to clarify in this case it's not messengers, it's dafka angels. The Hainu Shebetevis Mamash Haru Madgish Hoyu Malachim Mamash V'loi Metzias Achiras U'vemeile B'chol Mu'usav Inyon Shebechinas Malach. Now, if the whole point of Rashi saying Mamash is to emphasize that they were angels, not people, right? So the emphasis then must be on angels who are spiritual beings. And that's exactly what Rashi is emphasizing. And now you look at the Magid's explanation, it seems the opposite of Rashi. Rashi wants to highlight that they really, really were angels, i.e. spiritual beings. Comes along the Magid and says, no, it wasn't the spiritual part of the angels, it was the tangible part of the angels. That's what he sent. Seems to be contradictory. In fact, the way the Magid proposes it, what Esav experienced was not actual Malachim, it was kind of the Malachim outer shell. So we need to understand this teaching that the Mamash is what was sent, the tangible part of the angels is what was sent to Esav. How's it going to do what it needs to do to elevate Esav? How's it possible to split a malach in two? And surely that goes against what Rashi said. The malachim mamish means literally that he sent malachim. Al pi kol anal nira lei, mashen kabanasa shal amagid b'maimori anal lei, mashi agav sholach leesav raak esam mamish v'aguf shal malachim levad, shetofel chaloin nechshav, b'li ruchniusam v'nafshav. So therefore we have to conclude that the Magid's suggestion that mamish means the tangible part of the angels was sent to Esav does not mean that the ruchnius was left behind completely, because that wouldn't make any sense and would defeat the purpose and would go against Rashi's interpretation. So what is the Magid telling us? So here you've got the Rebbe explaining a story we've heard multiple times from the Magid of Mezrich, but perhaps we've never understood properly before, and now he'll explain it to us. It's an incredibly important point, and the entire Sikha will be built on this point. What the Magid is telling us is that even when the Malachim stood in front of Esav and appeared in the guise of Mamash, something which is more tangible and physical, they did not lose their connection to Yaakov who had sent them. Which means that those Malachim were acutely aware as they stood before Esav that this is foreign territory, we don't belong here. Where we belong, where our soul lives in the real sense of life, is by Yaakov. This is a temporary experience that we have to go through in order to fulfill a shlichus. It's not where we belong. So the implication of the mamash, the so-called tangential part of the malach being sent to Esav, is that they should feel, while I'm here, this is tofel, this is tangential, this doesn't define me, it's not what I'm about, it's not where I live, it's not what I care for, it's a foreign, hostile environment. So now it emerges that the Magid's explanation is certainly not in contradiction to Rashi's explanation that the mamish tangible part was sent to Esav. In fact, it turns out that the Magid is helping us to understand better what Rashi intended when he said only the mamish of the Malachim was sent to Esav. Ki ha'ef shoriya sheyesh me'malochim mamish defol biru be'esav tachlis agashmas ve'achurmis u'dafko keshen nafsham ruchniyusam dvuko k'shur be'yakov ve'eino mishtanis gam k'shehim nintzoyim eitzel esav. Because in order for these malachim to successfully fulfill their mission, which is to influence and upgrade and uplift and inspire Esav, the only way to do it is if they're plugged in. Only if they're still tethered to their source and acutely conscious of living with their source, even when they're at Esav. So that's actually exactly what Rashi is saying. Rashi is saying that they mamish were angels, even in the environment of Esav. And that's exactly what the Magid is saying. Only the mamish part of them engaged with the world of Esav, but they were still malachim in the fullest sense of the word, untainted by their environment, because they were acutely aware of the connection to Yaakov. So even when they engage with Esav, they remain malachim. They're not contaminated in any way by this experience. So the two explanations of the word mamish work together. Mamish, they were angels, because only the external part of the angel engaged with Esav. The core of the angel was always connected to Yaakov throughout the mission. In order to appreciate the real depth of what the Magid of Mezrich taught in this saying, and of course the lesson for us, it will help to contextualize it in the time frame when the Magid said this particular teaching. The fact that the Magid said this dafka on his last Shabbos in this world makes it almost like a last testament, the last will that he gave to the Hasidim for future generations to know what Hasidim are supposed to be, how they're supposed to think, how they're supposed to engage, how they're supposed to conduct themselves. And And especially when you consider that the primary student, the most beloved student that the Maggid of Mezrich had, was the Alter Rebbe, who of course founded Chassidus Chabad. As we know, the Maggid of Mezrich gave the Alter Rebbe special attention. He learned with him in a manner that he did not learn with the other students. Very famously, the Baditchev said that we all ate out of the same bowl, and he, the Lithuanian, which is how they refer to the Alter Rebbe, he got the best part of the meal, meaning to say he got the main teachings of the Maggid. So if the Maggid of Mezrich is leaving a legacy lesson, then surely it is directed primarily at the Alter Rebbe, his chief student, the one he invested the most in. So not only is this a generic lesson of what a chassid should be, this is a specific lesson of what a chassid chabad should be. Malachim mamash. So as we understand this concept thoroughly, we understand everything about our avoda as chabad chassidim. Aligned also with a famous line that the Maggid of Mezrich said to the Alter Rebbe, where he said, Yutis Kislev yom ha'ilula shelonu. He said that Yutis Kislev is the day of celebration for both of us. Because Yutes Kislev was both the yortzeit of the Maggid of Mezrich, and some years later, 20 odd years later, it was the day of release of the Alter Rebbe from prison, where he was in prison because of his work to spread Chassidus. So therefore, Mistava Loima Shatera Nal, Yois Vomra Magid if Neyo Mailula Sheloi, Yashla Shaikh Zmiyachedis, Leyo Mailula Shad Morazokin, Hain Leyo Mgula Sad Morazokin. So, in addition to the fact that the Magid's legacy message must apply especially to us as Chabad Hasidim, seeing the extra attention that the Magid gave to the Alter Rebbe, but the fact that the dates align, and that the Yom Ha'ilula of the Maggid, his Yortzeit, aligns the Yom Ha'ilula, the celebration of the Geula of the Alter Rebbe on Yutes Kislev, so that definitely must be very closely, this lesson must be very closely relevant to the message of Yutes Kislev. So what is the Geula, what is the celebration of Yutes Kislev all about? Yom Geula Zei Yutes Kislev Achidah Sheboi Hu Yafutzu Ma'nisecha Chutzah, as we very well know, the celebration was not about the individual release of one holy man from Russian prison, but Yutes Kislev is the celebration of spreading the wellsprings of Chassidus to the furthest reaches, as Moshiach had instructed the Baal Shem Tov to do. So it's self-understood what it means to spread these wellsprings, to share the words, the teachings of Chassidus as far and wide as possible. On a mikave and she saw miskashon beiraisa, but she saw beiraisa kulochad. Harimuv and shekasha nasa chidush bivchinas hatayra, nasa chidush dugmasa beisasha gam bivchinas Israel. It's a beautiful insight. The Rebbe notes over here. We know that the Torah and the Jewish people are indelibly interconnected. So we connect Hashem through the Torah, but also it says yisov beiraisa kulochad. The Torah and the Jews are one. If there's a complete shift and innovation in Torah, a new dimension of Torah, a new approach to sharing that dimension, then you take these wellsprings of Torah and you spread them, the secrets of Torah, to the furthest reaches. Then at the same time that innovation happens within the Torah realm, there's a similar shift that happens within us as people. Yisrael, the Jewish nation, are connected to the Torah. When the Torah is unleashed in a new manner, we're unleashed in a new manner. And we're going to see exactly that happen in the nature of what occurred on Yutes Kislev. So what happened on Yutes Kislev? A new degree of spreading the so-called soul of Torah, Nishmosa Doiraisa, Pnimius HaTorah, the inner dimension of Torah, which is called the soul of Torah, took off in a whole different way, in a whole different level of extent and expounding the teachings and sharing them in language that people could understand. It was an incredible revolution in terms of making accessible what previously was the most guarded part of the Torah. Prior to Yutus Kislev, the biggest dimension of Torah that was revealed to the public was the so-called body of Torah, meaning to say the easily accessible, revealed part of the Torah, the Gemara, Halacha, Chumash, Midrash, philosophy, etc. But the real soul of Torah, and understand that the concept of soul of Torah doesn't just mean the hidden part of Torah. Just like the soul gives life to the body, this is the dimension of Torah that brings the whole body of wisdom to life. And all of that had been hidden prior, at least to the majority of the population, prior to Yutes Kislev. The distinction between these two parts of Torah is reflected in the distinction between a human being, the difference between the body and soul of a human being. The human body you can see, you can touch, you can feel, it's tangible, it's real. Whereas the neshama, you cannot perceive with any of the five senses. You can't see, smell, taste, touch, hear the neshama. The truth is, even the intellect, which is a much more refined and developed, nuanced part of human perception, even the intellect of the human being can't understand the neshama. Human intellect is capable of appreciating that such a thing as a soul exists. You look at a body, you understand there must be something which animates it, so you conclude logically that there has to be a soul. But what the soul is remains beyond human comprehension. So the body, touch it with your hand. The soul, you can't even probe it with your mind. That's the great innovation of the Alter Rebbe. In the same way as you can't understand the soul, you couldn't understand with the human mind the secrets of Torah. They're beyond human comprehension. Comes along Yutes Kislev, comes along the Alter Rebbe, comes along the system of Chabad Chassidus, and makes that which should be beyond our minds accessible for us to study and understand Chochmah Bina Das, Chabad, to actually integrate these concepts, not only to understand them in abstract, not only to understand them in detail, but to understand them in personal practice. Behinei. Now, as the Rebbe noted, there's this indelible connection between Torah and the Jewish people. So at a time when the neshama of Torah comes to the surface, comes to light, in a similar vein, the neshama of the Jewish people come to light in a whole new way. The radical revolution of Chassidus, the radical effect of Yutes Kislev, is not only that we have access to information which previously was beyond the scope of our understanding, the fact that our own neshama can now radiate and shine and reveal itself in an unprecedented fashion and in such a way that it can impact our physical reality. Let's understand that a little better. In order to understand this, we appreciate that the impact of the neshama on the body, or the capacity to reveal the neshama within the body, could happen in two general ways. The first, and probably the more common version, is where the neshama overtakes the body, controls the body, directs the body, so the person is living now a much more meaningful, spiritual, aspirational kind of life. But the body still remains an entity, still has its own senses, still has its own reality. Shortly, the Rebbe will give us an example of how you can see this in very practical terms. Or, Shanashami Bizgalas Kol Kach Be'aguf, Achaguf Einemetzis Latzmoy Klal Amitesin and Gilei Neshame Beguf. The alternative is that the neshama is so pervasive, so clear, so tangible, so real, that you actually lose touch with the body. You overlook the body. And he gives an example, not from the neshama so much, as from the animal part of our soul, the nefesh habahamis, the so-called animal or animating soul, where you see exactly these things happen in real life, things that you and I can all relate to, and from that we can extrapolate to the neshama. ודוגמה לגוף הנפש הבא מספח יונס. הרי אפשר לחלק ביניהם, אלוהים, שהגוף הוא מציאס לעצמי, וכי הוא עושה רצוני של הנפש רק על ידי ציווי שליטה. No person would say, I have a body, and then I have a nefesh abahamis, which instructs the body to do things, and the body listens and follows those instructions. We don't split ourselves like that. We say, I have a motivation, which my body automatically, as I want to move, so I move. There's no delays. So the reality is, because the nefesh achyunis is the battery pack of my body, so they're completely connected, completely united, completely smooth sailing the transmission of impulse into action. There's no delay, it's just a natural process, because the two entities are completely intertwined in the deepest, most realistic way. So my nefesh abahamis doesn't have to tell me. Doesn't have to tell me, you need to talk, move lips, activate teeth, move the tongue. It just happens. It's a natural flow without any blockage because the two entities operate in absolute harmony. And not only do they operate in absolute harmony, the body doesn't feel distinct from the nefesh abahamis. The body doesn't have a sensation of, I am an entity that has a feeder from the outside telling me what to do. We are an entity together. Al derech zeh, hu benegea, lechayis haneshama bivnei yisrael, datem kri modem, hashem adam ele elyen, shegam chayus hamagash misimei nefesh elikis. Now, where it gets a little bit different and unique about being Jewish is that a Jewish person has a nefesh elikis, a godly soul, and that godly soul is also part and parcel of how we live, what makes us live. Shekol inyonu mitzius ha-duguf ha-yisraeli shukeli le-haneshama. The uniqueness of being Jewish is not only that I have a neshama, which is beautiful and special and unique and connected to Hashem. Neshama shenasata bi tohoira, the neshama you gave me is pure, and it's a chelek adakami mal mamash, a piece of Hashem within me. The greatness of being Jewish is that my body is designed to be the perfect transmitter for that neshama. Everybody on planet Earth is the perfect transmitter for an animalistic soul. The uniqueness of the Jewish body is that it is calibrated to be the perfect vehicle for a neshama that is godly.
And
you can see this practically, because if the neshama wants to achieve any of the things that it wants to achieve, it needs a body. You cannot do mitzvahs without a body. That's why souls in Gan Eden are a wonderful thing, but they can't grow, they can't develop, and they cannot do mitzvahs. If I want to put on tefillin, I need arms and a head. If I want to put on tzitzis, I need a body, and so on.
Hari shemitzusa shel haguf hu letachli zoi sheboi val yodoi pe'elas haneshama mashlim es tafkidu boi lamazeh.
Turns out that the human body of a Jewish person is perfectly designed for the neshama to be able to achieve its objectives in this world. Why does a Jewish person have a body? To do mitzvahs, to fulfill Hashem's will in this world.
So it's a merit that all tachlis mitziusa shel ish ha-yisraeli ain't a liyaz mishkan lo yisborech ma'am razal al ha-pasuk v'ase ni migdash ha-shachanti b'soichon b'soichoy lo yinemar ela b'soichoy b'soichoy lecha v'echon
Mi'Yisrael. So why do I live as a Jewish person? Why am I here in physical form? Not to make money, not to find fame, not to enjoy life. Why am I here? To create inside this body a home for Hashem. Just as there was a Mishkan that was constructed in the desert, and there and then Hashem said, make that Mishkan, v'shachanti b'soi cham, I will dwell within you. That's what my body is here for, to be Hashem's temple, a place of manifestation of godliness through me.
Ve'inu mitzis le'atzmoi, not for me to be independent and then signing up occasionally to fulfill missions that Hashem gave me.
My relationship with Hashem is like a dedicated wife who does as her husband would want. That doesn't mean that she loses her identity. That doesn't mean that she has no... We're not talking over here about some kind of an abusive relationship. We're talking about a person who has this beautiful connection, and all you want to do is you want to do what the other wants of you. And even more than that, halacha says that if a woman acquires something while she's married, it's automatically part of her husband's assets. In other words, whatever I do as a Jewish person is automatically what Hashem wants. That's the goal and objective. That's how I should live my life. That should be my aspiration. So that whatever I'm doing in my life is automatically aligned with what Hashem wants. So going back to the halacha, but it's not like a woman picks something up off the ground, she finds something lying on the street and says, oh, I'm going to give this to my husband when I get home. They have such a bond, they have such a connection that as soon as she picks it up, it's already in his possession. That's how we should be with Hashem. That's how our body is designed. You'll say, not all of us are at that level that we feel that our relationship with Hashem is like this beloved, dedicated wife. Well, in that case, at the very least, we are in the context, in the classification of Hashem's servant. The Altareba tells us in Tanya, the core of the whole process of serving Hashem is to be a dedicated servant. Even in the case of a servant, halacha is the same. The servant acquires something, it is automatically part of the assets of the master. It's not just that the servant doesn't rebel against his master, ignore his instructions. And not just that he agrees, okay, whatever the master wants, that's what I'm going to do. Even to say, I'm going to donate my things to my master. His attitude, his psychology is, if I come across something, it automatically is my owner's. That's the attitude of the Jewish body, or at least how it should be. If I come across an experience, an activity, an opportunity in life, it is automatically Hashem's asset. I'm not doing things for me. That's not why I'm here. So the psychology, the thinking, the approach of a Jewish person should be, my body is designed to be a conduit for Hashem's mission in this world, to fulfill whatever it is to bring holiness into every single environment that I touch. So what did we say? We said there are two ways that the neshama and body could interact. The one is the neshama is, so to speak, in control and the body conforms. And the higher level is that the neshama and body are so in sync that they automatically dovetail. That the body automatically aligns with what the neshama wants. So, beis majegas and albeif and gilei haneshama. Alef shaneshama rak sheletes alaguf. Beis shaguf einem etzis that's my klal. So, these two different possibilities of how the neshama will interact with and control the body, either that it's with force and control and the body conforms, or that it completely seamlessly integrates into the body. Hein behesen the beis ifane ho avoida kol maasech yudol shem shamayim ubuchol drachecho do'ehu. These two align with two sayings that we have of how a person should serve Hashem over and above the fulfillment of mitzvahs. One saying is that all of your actions should be directed towards heaven. And the other saying is, you should know Hashem in all your ways. So we're going to explore the difference between these two approaches and see how they align with the difference between the two possibilities of how the neshama influences the body. It's discussed many times in Chassidus. The Rebbe speaks about it many times, that there's a big distinction between these two approaches. If I go with the first view, which says, kol ma'asecha, all of your deeds, all of your actions, l'shem shamayim, should be directed towards heaven, that's an orientation. So I do deeds, and I orient them in a particular way. I'm consciously aware that I'm supposed to serve Hashem. Aval ha'maasim atzmam hem inyon chol. But what I'm doing is actually mundane. I'm doing a mundane activity with a higher motive. So I'm eating, that's mundane, but I have a higher motive, which is I'm going to serve Hashem through the process of eating. I'll say a bracha, make sure the food is kosher, and maybe I'll use the energy to serve Hashem, or whatever the case is. So while I'm eating, I'm eating. Why am I eating? I also have a deeper motivation. Whereas the second level, know Hashem in all your ways, means there's no such thing as I eat to serve Hashem. Eating is a consciousness of Hashem. As I eat, the experience of eating is an experience of awareness of Hashem. What does that mean?
אף שלכאורה מקום לא ימשל דרך היחידי לעבוד דאגס דאי הוא על ידי עניין הקידוש אני מתאר עושה של הקדוש ברוך הוא וקיים מצווי סוף.
Most people will tell you, listen, the only way to really know Hashem in an experience would be if the experience is mandated by Hashem. So if it's Torah learning, obviously while I'm learning Torah, I see godliness in the Torah. If I'm doing a mitzvah, obviously the mitzvah was instructed by Hashem, so while I'm doing the mitzvah, I see godliness.
אבל איך יגיע לזה ביסעסק בניון הראשוס? במאכולוי, במשקי, במסוי, במתונוי?
But how am I supposed to have that degree of consciousness while I'm eating breakfast or doing a deal at the office, which are holy, mundane activities?
So that's the expression in all your ways, your personal activities, there too should be absolutely informed by consciousness of Hashem.
And it should be shachil atzmati kedusha mitzvah. Loi rak shebekoicha yilmod vispal achar kach.
So the experience is then I don't eat now so that later I'll have energy to do a mitzvah. I eat now because this is a recognition of Hashem in my life. Now, of course, it's going to take a lot of learning and conscious shifting in order to get to that point, but that's the goal.
Examples that we can look at, we'll come back to the one example shortly. You eat on Shabbos, you don't have to say, I'm eating and later I'll use the energy to serve Hashem. The fact that I'm eating in respect of Shabbos already makes it special. If a person ate the meat of a korban, well, the korban is completely holy from top to bottom. It's kachim. If I go to a suda mitzvah, I go to a bris, I'm at a wedding, this is a mitzvah. So I don't have to consciously now think I'm eating so that later I can do a mitzvah. This eating is a mitzvah. The challenge for us is to be able to do that at an ordinary lunchtime. It was not so simple.
Now we can start to align these two approaches of how to serve Hashem with the two possibilities of how the neshama communicates with the body.
As long as the relationship between my neshama and body is just that my neshama controls and directs the body, but the body itself is mostly independent of the neshama, and it just follows those instructions. Well, if that's the case, my whole approach will be kol ma'asecha, then my actions, l'shem shamayim, with an intention that they will bring me later to do something which is aligned with what Hashem wants.
So I said, Meir Shadibra Oshus and Yonah Guf Tosim Etz Namakim Kimitzius Le'atzmom Elo Sh'aguf Chol Yonah Kfuy Minichnoy Minishama Sheletes Olav Uvamele Noise Befeil Shum Dabar Kim L'shem Shamayim.
Which basically means, at that point, I'd have an attitude that says, food is enjoyable, but I will overcome my sense of just eating for my sake, and I'll create a consciousness of eating in order to have energy to serve Hashem later. But as far as I'm concerned, I enjoy eating. That's a fact.
But can you imagine if a person's neshama is so tangible, so palpable, then what happens is you don't feel that the body is an independent, self-serving entity.
Then everything in your life is just another channel of connection to Hashem. So whatever physical experience you have is naturally a channel of connection to Hashem. That's how you see it. That's how you experience it. Because your neshama is what you feel. Your neshama is how you live. So two completely distinct possibilities. The person who lives with a, listen, I'm a realist. I understand that the person has needs, the person has drives, but we also have responsibility. So I'll direct those drives to fulfill that responsibility. Versus the person who says, I'm absolutely conscious 24/7 of my neshama, and therefore if the body has any role to play, it must be a role that is aligned with the neshama, nothing else. No veering left or right.
And then we can take it deeper.
We started off by saying that generally speaking, there are these two approaches. The approach of the neshama kind of overwhelming the body and getting it to conform, which leads to kol ma'asecha l'shem shamayim, that my deeds that are mundane will have a value assigned to them. Versus b'chol drachecha do'eihu, which is the neshama is completely open and palpable, and therefore everything that I do is automatically aligned with Hashem. Well, that one, that's the general two different levels. Within b'chol drachecha do'eihu, there's also two levels. Number one, Aleph. The one possibility is where a person is very focused, everything I do is holy, my entire orientation is holiness, my entire life is built around my neshama. But that doesn't mean I don't feel the reality of this world. And he has a really good example. Let's take eating on Shabbos, right? So we already identified that eating on Shabbos is already holy. It's already aligned with the neshama. I don't need another purpose. I don't need to say I'm eating now, so I have energy later to do a mitzvah. The fact that I'm eating for Shabbos is already a mitzvah. It's already holy. It's already aligned with the neshama. But in order to do it, the thing is I have to eat good food. So what does good food mean? That means that I'm absolutely dedicated to Hashem, and I can even comment on the fact that this is good food. I can be conscious and say, this good food is for the sake of Shabbos. You see, I still have a tangible sense of this world. And my dominant sense is my neshama and connection to Hashem, but I still have a tangential sense of this world. And then there's a level that is completely beyond that, and which is, shekol inyon avagashmim betelim imichodim kol kach belikus, then there's another level altogether, which means that the person is so focused on spirituality, no, on godliness, on elikus, on divine awareness, that the body totally dissolves into the background. It's completely irrelevant. It's just a tool. It's just a vehicle. This doesn't mean that there's so much blinding light of the neshama that I no longer see the body. It's that the body has been upgraded and converted to become kedusha. The body itself radiates holiness. That's an incredible level to achieve. And there too, we can borrow a little experience from our animal soul to help us understand how this is possible. Because one of the rules that we know about the animal soul is, and the way that it operates through the body, is you generally are unaware of it. And that's a sign of good health. When you're unaware of the body, you're unaware of the flow of energy, as we'll see. If your body is healthy, you don't feel it. The fact that you don't feel your body is the sign that your body is healthy. The minute you start to feel something in your body, you know that something's not right. If you feel pain, you feel heaviness, something's not right. That is an alert that your body is sending you that things are not as healthy as they should be. Why? Because as long as the connection between body and nefesh achiyunus, the animating soul, is healthy and there's no blockage to the flow, you don't have to feel it because everything works as it should. If I feel something in my body, that means that there's an obstruction. The energy is not flowing as seamlessly as it's meant to. That's why something's rubbing, something's hurting. So I need to look and see what's the blockage, what's the problem. So what's a healthy Jew? A healthy Jew is you don't feel any disconnect between the neshama and the body. A healthy human, there's no disconnect between the nefesh and the body. The animating God, animal soul, there's no breakdown. It just flows. The energy goes to every part of the body as it should. Every part of the body works seamlessly, no issues. A Jewish person should be that way with regards to their neshama. The neshama should flow so easily and so seamlessly through every part of the body that there's no obstruction. There's no pain in doing a mitzvah, no discomfort, no tiredness, no feeling of heaviness. This is overwhelming. So many, it should be natural. The body itself should be a conduit of holiness. Take, for example, eating. It's always a good example because it's the most ubiquitous human experience. שכל הרגושוסי בזה שעליו להמשך לקוס בדובר נך, אבל ידוי בו למה זה גשמי בחומרי על ידי החילוסי זוי. ומכיוון שהמשוך הזוי היא על ידי זה שמבורך. Okay, we'll come to the bracha in a second. So, what's the experience of eating? The experience of eating should be that this is a way that I bring and channel godliness into me and my surrounds. That's what eating is. Most people think that eating is enjoyment, pleasure, social interaction, and nutrition. For me, eating is an opportunity to generate godliness in this world. As we say in the bracha, what's the bracha we say before we eat? Shanuscha, Baruch Ato Hashem Elokeinu, Melech Ha'olam, which means Shemamshich Elokus Ba'olam. That's what we say in the bracha. We say that the purpose, I'm about to eat, it's an incredible thought when you consider it. I'm about to eat food, one of the most self-serving things that humans or animals do. I want to survive, I want to sustain myself, it's instinctive. And what do we do as a Jewish person? You're about to eat, you say, Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam. The purpose of this eating is to bring Elokus, godliness, that should rule and inform and direct Ha'olam, the world. That's what we say, that's why I'm eating. I'm eating so that I could say a brocha, and as an extension of that brocha, use this experience as a way to channel godly energy into the world. So the way that I eat should be with only soul consciousness of the concept. Jewish person, kosher food, saying a brocha, this is a conduit to bring divine awareness into the world. That's how and why I should eat. The same thing can apply to business. So how do you conduct business? Like everybody else. Same rules. You have a marketing team. You have a sales team. You have a development team. Whatever it is that you have to have in your business. You negotiate. You have meetings. You have clients. You have suppliers. Like everybody else. It's just that what motivates you, what drives you, how you perceive business is totally, radically different to everybody else. Everybody else looking to make a buck. Everybody else is looking to create a network. You're looking to direct godliness into the world via this particular channel, which happens to be your business. Just as you do with food, just as you do with social interaction and every other part of living. Like the well-known story of one of the famous Hasidim of the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Yomin Kletzker, so the story goes, he was a lumber merchant and he was doing an accounting of how the business was going, and it came to the bottom, at the bottom of the whole accounting sheet he had to write, Sach Hakol, the total of everything. So he wrote, Ein Oid Milvadoi, there's nothing besides Hashem. That is the sum total of everything. And that wasn't, it wasn't a trick. It wasn't to be cute. That's how he saw his business. Why do I have a business? To express godliness in this world. In whichever way it is. If it's through the people that I meet and I share insight with them and I inspire them and teach them Torah, get them to do mitzvahs. If it's to be able to give tzedakah. If it's to be able to recognize godliness in the merchandise itself. However he saw, that's how he saw his business. The business is not about me and it's not about my empire and it's not about my earnings. It's about expressing godliness in the world. So that's the real, real depth of B'chol Derochecha Do'ehu, knowing Hashem in all your ways, which is the real depth of experiencing and sharing the depth of the neshama out on the surface in real life, like the Alter Rebbe wanted to do, to take the depths of Chassidus and translate it into the real language of real people to impact their life in a real way. Kol Pratvin B'Avodas Hashem, Shetes Chassidus D'Reshem Kol Echa V'Echad, Ine L'Roi Shal Yishon Esol Rabbi Seinu Neseinu B'Avodosim Heimes HaDerech L'Avodos Zoi. Whatever it is that the Rebbeim insisted that we should do, they first blazed a path for us to be able to follow them to do these things. So here's an example. We're talking about a kind of avoda, a dedication to Hashem, which is so compelling and so overwhelming that you don't even feel the physicality of this world. You only see Einoid Movadoi in the lumber yard. So the Alter Rebbe had a story in his life, well-known story, that illustrates how the Alter Rebbe himself lived at that level, to perfection. The Alter Rebbe once hosted a very important guest. The Rebbe does not say in the Sicha who the important guest was. It was certainly one of his colleagues who had studied together with him under the Magid of Mezrich.
אשר לרוב חשיבוס החליט בני בייסד אדמר הזוכנה שיחלוק בניהם אס פרוטי אוהבוידה דאבישל וסידה מאכולים לכבוידה וכך אבא.
Because it was such an honor to serve this guest, the family members divided all of the tasks, all of the responsibilities of preparing the meal between them so everybody could participate. And that's what they did.
אבל פרט אחד נשכח בסדר החלוקה, מי מאנשי הבית יזכה בתולס מלך בתבשיל.
The one thing that was overlooked was who would be allocated to put the salt into the food.
ולכן, כשכל אחד ואחד נזכר אחר כך הדבר המלך, רוצה כל אחד לזרקס בזה והיטל אס מנס המלך ומייכל מבלי לספר מזה להשני.
And then, obviously, when the cooking was in progress, each family member suddenly remembered, ooh, nobody took responsibility for the salt. So I want the skos, I want the merit, I'm going to put in the salt. Which means that every family member then put in the salt.
Kasher huva atavshe lifnei admar hazakim v'hoi reach,
when this meal was now brought before the Alter Rebbe and his guest,
achle admar hazakim kiragil,
the Alter Rebbe ate it like nothing.
Aval horeach tomes amachav v'silkei atzida.
The guest, on the other hand, tasted it. It was completely overloaded with salt. So he put it aside.
Kshashol admar hazakim lama eino eichel,
heshiva shom amaluch b'yoyser. The Alter Rebbe asked him, why are you not eating? In those days, there was no political correctness. They were direct and honest with each other. So the guest said, it's too salty. I can't eat it. Not possible.
So, Aneyu Admar Azokin, Sh'oid B'yosem B'mezrich, Paul Al-Atzmoy Shalahar Gishtam B'Maychol.
So the Alter Rebbe said, when he was still a student of the Maggid of Mezrich, he worked to the point that he no longer tastes food. In other words, the experience of eating for him was not a culinary experience. It was a soul experience. It wasn't about the flavor or the texture. It was about the capacity to be able to bring godliness into the world. Salt or no salt, what's the difference?
Now, obviously, to reach such a point where you don't even taste a dish that is so salty it's inedible, that's a very lofty level which the Alter Rebbe could have achieved.
The fact that the story became public and we are aware of the story means that we also have to aspire to this at least sometimes.
And even if you'll never ever get to such a point where you're so caught up and enraptured with your experience of godliness that you actually don't taste the food.
But there's another option, and that's the option to get so busy, so caught up, so invested in doing what Hashem wants, you don't have the time or energy to pay attention to the materialism of the physical experience.
As we see, people can get so caught up and worked up in emotional situations that they don't appreciate food.
So that's not necessarily a healthy thing, but in spiritual terms, it could be really healthy, where a person becomes so caught up and so excited about engaging with Hashem, doing what Hashem wants, that the food is really it's not important, it's not interesting. I'm too busy, I've got other things to do. Speak to a workaholic, they'll tell you, I'm so busy, I didn't get a time to eat. You know, eat on the fly.
So we're not suggesting over here that you eat in an unhealthy manner, but the point is not to be invested in the materialism of the experience because you're too caught up in the responsibility of your spiritual job.
This is all a means of helping us to understand what the great achievement and innovation of Yutis Kislev, spreading the wellsprings of Hasidus to the furthest reaches, is really all about.
In that expression, to spread the wellsprings to the furthest reaches, there are two things to emphasize.
So the first thing we emphasize is that the wellspring itself moves from its place to the destination. So you would think that the wellsprings, meaning to say the insight, the Torah, the Chassidus, impacts at a long distance all the way into the world out there. That's not the message. The message is that the Chassidus gets to the world. It actually moves from its secure, pristine place into the world that it is supposed to impact. And how far does it reach? That's the second point.
The expression is yofutsu, that it should spread and spread and spread and spread till there's nowhere untouched.
Because if there's any place untouched by the mayonos, by these wellsprings of Torah, then it's not really your futsu, then it hasn't really spread in the greater sense. There's a limit on the spread. Didn't get that far, didn't touch that area. And how does that apply to us individually? So there we get it. Chassidus has to, there has to be a deluge of Chassidus to every single part of the world. And what does it mean to me as an individual? On a personal level, I have my spring, my pure, unadulterated spring of holiness. It's called my neshama. A neshama that was crafted from beneath Hashem's throne of glory, and it's tahoirahi, it's absolutely pure. In a Mayan Zetzarchius, that's like Begir Gamidyanam Agufnim Sheboy, Hashemitzad Atzmamim Bechinas Chutzim Yichutzim Tchum Nishmasoy. And that's exactly, now we bring all the themes together. That's what it means to spread the mayonis, that my neshama should spread its impact and influence and awareness into every part of the outer reaches of my physical self. That every part of my body should be aligned and smoothly with the neshama. Now, just as we said with Hafatzus and Mayonis spreading Chassidus, that there are two things to emphasize, that the wellspring itself moves to the destination, and that the reach has to be absolute, both things apply to the Neshama. It's not enough to have a Neshama which, so to speak, from a distance, influences the body and controls it, but rather the Neshama has to flow right through every element of the body. As we've already explained, that it's not just a person going through a whole lot of activities and saying, but I have a holy intention. It's rather that every activity should be holy. And second of all, she's pashas and Hashem b'maguf v'nyonim bo'if and she'afutzo. His pashas built in mugbeles atchloi nish'ar mokim lehergash ha'guf l'fish and Hashem tefeses b'chuloi. And then you want the neshama to override the body to such an extent that there's no part of me that still feels like me, that still feels independent of Hashem, that still has interests and desires. The goal is that the neshama should be so much the informer of the reality in my life that there's no part of my body that's not aligned with the neshama. It's quite an aspiration, right? Let's bring this all back to the Malachim Mamash. Because we said that the Magid's statement about sending the Malachim Mamish, the tangible part of the angels, to Esav, was deliberately a Yutis Kislev, which is associated with his own passing, and therefore is a legacy message to his students, but specifically to the Alter Rebbe, who is his chief student, and specifically because Yutis Kislev is the time of Yofutzu Manesecha Chutzu, the real release of Chabad Chassidus in the world. So Yom Yistalkus Soi, it was said on the day of his passing. And as mentioned, it's very strongly related to the concept of Yutis Kislev, the Alter Rebbe's redemption. The souls descend into this world with the goal and mission to transform this world into a home for Hashem, a place of divine clarity. The journey of our neshama into this world to elevate the world is very much like the journey of those malachim that Yaakov sent to refine and elevate Esav. We've already identified that in order for that mission that Yaakov had to elevate and refine Esav, he needed Malachim Mamish, with all the different interpretations of what that means, the tangible part, but literally Malachim. It's the same with us. If we're going to influence the world of Esav, the world of Toyo, of spiritual chaos, which is very much aligned with Esav's energy. If we're going to change the world, what do we need? We need our Malachim Mamish. We need to get hold of our spirituality and release our spirituality in its unadulterated form.
Because, as we've already discussed, there is the option that the neshama is kind of distant, but controlling the body, and therefore the actions of the body are mundane, but with a spiritual intention, but still conscious of themselves. Because that's a possibility, and that's why the Maggid of Mezrich insists that in order to achieve the goal, to refine Esav as is required, to refine the world that we live in, you have to make sure that your neshama only puts the mamash part of it into this world. In other words, there is a part of your neshama that engages the physical, but it's the outer part of the neshama. It's the shell. It's the uniform of the neshama. The neshama itself has to be connected to its source. Or to put it into different words, the malachim filter right through to the mamash. So there's a part of Manishama which is engaged with the world. But that part of Manishama which is engaged with the world is not just the external part of Manishama. Malachim mamish, even while I'm at Esav, I'm connected to Yaakov. Even while I'm in this world, the Mayonos themselves are chutzah, the essence of my spirituality, of my divine connection, my nefesh elikis, that essence comes all the way to the chutzah. There's no distance, there's no disconnect, there's no breakdown between what I do in my daily life and who I am on the inside of my neshama. It's one uninterrupted flow. There's no pain, there's no disconnect, there's no discomfort.
And we can certainly translate this into the practice of sharing chassidus throughout the world, which is the literal meaning of yafutzu manisecha chutzah. The system that the Rebbeim came up with was that they send shluchim representatives all over the world to share chassidus. These shluchim need to be very conscious of this lesson of malachim mamish, meaning kloimar. It goes without saying that the shliach has to fulfill his mission, and not just as a, you know, going through the list, checking off the responsibilities, but actually with the investment of every fiber of his being and his neshama. B'chol zois, alav gam li'zorim oid shemekim shalachutzah shaboyim eifzim ha'yonis lo'yifol bo'y shemirid ha'chas v'shonim. But it is critical that the shliach knows, I don't live in that place. I have to go to that place. I have to influence the place. I don't belong in that place. It is foreign and hostile territory. Like the Malachim knew, Esav, only the mamash goes there. I don't live there. The mamash goes there. There's a part of me that has to connect. And even though I'll throw every bit of my neshama into that in order to elevate it, it doesn't become my space. I don't live there.
So how do you do this? How do you succeed? How do you make sure that not only are you not impacted by the world, but in fact you transform the world, that it itself should become a mayon, a source of its own independent giving of holiness? How? That even when you're a malach at Esav, you're a malach of Yaakov. You're absolutely conscious of who set you up to the task, who sent you, and what the motivation and mindset that you have to have is. It's a mindset of connection to the source wherever I am, whenever it might be. This is a lesson from the Maggid to Shluchim.
Only the external part of yourself gets to the business of what you're doing out there. But where do you live? Where do you live? You live with Yaakov. Where do you live? You live with the Mashalayach. Where do you live? You live with the Rebbe. What does this mean practically?
That whatever you're doing, it's the Rebbe's shlichus. It's not your personal thing. It's not your innovation. It's not your creativity. It's not your wisdom.
It's the Rebbe Shlichus. But the Gemara Guf Mama shall come to Yusim Inyan Rak Aruch Nis Vane Shama Shaboy Shehol Se Aruch Niusim Yaitzalam Shaleach. Like we already described, that when is the body healthy? When the body does not feel detached from the soul. When the body recognizes that I'm moving and I'm living because there's an neshama making me move and live. Like the Baal Shem Tov famous, he says, wherever your will is, that's where you really are. So if your will is, I want to be with the Mishaleach, I want to be in the Mishaleach's world, reality, that's where you are. Doesn't matter where in the world you live, doesn't matter who you engage with, doesn't matter how many challenges, that is your world and your reality. The fact that we have this teaching and the fact that we try to keep this teaching empowers us. We're not left on to our own devices with this huge responsibility and expectation. If we work to fulfill the directive of the Rebbe to stay connected no matter where we are, that empowers us to remain connected. And then we'll have the success not only of our own shlichus of transforming our piece of the world that it should become a wellspring of kedusha, but we have the possibility of transforming the entire world, the mountain of Esav, that which represents everything that is a barrier to kedusha in the world should be transformed. And Hashem will be recognized as the king of the entire world. The Rebbe says in the note of Yom Melech, not Moishel, that it means it's a kind of rulership that the world welcomes and embraces, doesn't feel that it's compelled onto them. The coming of Mashiach, which should happen, take of miyad.